Welcome to the Planting Wildflowers podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Leonardis. I'm an entrepreneur, wife, mom, and stepmom. I'm super interested in people and perspectives, and I love how a good conversation can leave you feeling empowered. Sometimes even pique your curiosity to learn and grow. Mostly though, I love how really listening to one another opens up limitless opportunities for that beautiful sense of connection and community that we all love. Thanks for tuning in. Let's be inspired. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Planting Wildflowers podcast. Do I ever have an amazing episode for you today? Friends, I am here with Dr. Jillian Mandich. This conversation is going to blow your mind. I have listened and followed her for such a long time and completely love and appreciate how she has given her all to her research, and what she brings to the table is an unbelievable wealth of knowledge and information for all of us to indulge in. Literally indulge yourself in this episode today. She is all about happiness. Now tell me, is this conversation not perfectly timed for the times we are in right now? We are needing to know more about how to fuel our own personal happiness. We are looking for ways to support others that we love in creating and cultivating their personal happiness. This information that you're going to take away today will leave you a changed person. Because once you know information, you can't unknow it. Even if you do nothing with it today, it's going to sit with you forever. And when you choose to lean back on what you've learned from this informative session with Dr. Jillian today, I know that you will find a way to create and elevate your happiness. I am so happy you're here. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Jillian, everyone. First of all, she is a PhD from Western University in health science. She specializes in health promotion. Her primary areas of research are happiness and health, and her work combines the latest research, practical wisdom, and engaging style. Her whole goal is to help people live happier, healthier lives. She's the founder of the International Happiness Institute of Health Science Research and is part of the Meant to Prevent research team at SickKids. You guys might know Dr. Jillian Mandich because she appears regularly in the media on shows such as The Social, Marilyn Dennis, Breakfast Television, The Morning Show, and CBC. She is everywhere, you guys, spreading this message. And it gives me such great pleasure to welcome you to the show, Dr. Jillian. How are you?
Hi, thank you so much for having me today. I've been really looking forward to spending this time talking to you.
It's a good time to be talking about happiness, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think we're in interesting times, weird times, just strange, unbelievable times, but happiness is something that we're all in pursuit of, most definitely, but something that is a real personal pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, first of all. Like maybe take us, first of all, what led you to this? What brings someone to research happiness and its relationship to health?
You know, this is such an interesting question because, you know, I'm so happy with, and I love so much the work that I do now. It's not like when I was in high school, I sat down and was talking to my guidance counselor and said, you know, when I grow up, I want to study happiness. Like that was not what happened.
Right.
I was always really good at math and science growing up. So I thought, what do you do if you're good at math and science? You become a doctor, right? So I did an undergrad degree at Western in health science. And I specialized in health promotion because my interest has always been, and we're aligned on this, where we get one shot at life. So how do we live our best life ever, right? What tools and strategies and information is available to really maximize or make our, like take the best shot we can at life. Mm-hmm. And so, that's what I did. I specialized in health promotion. And then after my undergrad degree, something in my gut was like, don't go to med school, defer for a year, go work, get some life experience. I was very young. I don't know how old are you when you finish, like 20 or 21. Uh-huh. So I thought, why don't I work for a year, get some real world experience, and then I'll go back to school and do my medical degree. And during that time, I ended up getting a job at the Middlesex London Health Unit in London. And I was in their research department. They had a research department. I worked as a research assistant, and I was working, doing a lot of family and parent focused interventions to address childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. So we did a lot of work out of the YMCA, working like healthy living with families. And I realized, wow, you know what? I think I like research. I love asking questions. If you talk to any of my friends, they will tell you I ask a lot of questions. I'm highly curious. And so I thought, this might be a better fit for me to be able to do research. And so if you want to do your own research, you need more letters after your name. So I went back to Western, did a master's degree in child and youth health, and went right into my PhD. Halfway through my PhD, I ended up completely switching topics to study happiness. So what happened was, when I was doing my comprehensive exams, which is a very stressful time during your PhD, you're given a topic and you have to read like all the literature on it. And then you have to write a paper and sit and have a 3-hour oral exam. Very stressful. But I was looking at these childhood obesity interventions, and I was using BMI as a cutoff. So body mass index, which is calculated using weight and height. And when I really stopped to think about that, something didn't sit right with me, because I thought, why am I using weight as a metric to determine if I can help somebody or not? Because we know, and it's very clear in the research, that you can be overweight and obese. You can be like living with obesity or classified based on your BMI as overweight or obese. And you can still be healthy, and you cannot be overweight or obese and be unhealthy. So weight is not the indicator of health. Right. So I started thinking, well, then why am I using that in a health intervention? So I started looking into the literature to see, well, what else impacts health? And I found happiness research. Up until that point, honestly, I didn't even know people studied happiness. And as soon as a light bulb went off in my head, and I went down the research rabbit hole and started reading all this information. And basically, when you compare happy people to unhappy people, they have low rates of cardiovascular disease, they have stronger immune systems, they heal faster from injury. So from a physical health perspective, a lot of benefits. From a mental health perspective, a lot of benefits. From a workplace, even like in terms of productivity, creativity, cooperation, altruism, relationships, marriages, so many areas of our life are really impacted by our happiness, and they can be improved. And so I thought, this seems like a way more interesting topic. It takes weight completely out of the equation, and it helps everybody. And so I have never looked back. To this day, I will tell you, so often people ask me if I have a real job, because happiness researcher is not a common occupation. Right. But if I would have said to you, you know, oh, I'm a nutrition researcher or a physical activity researcher, everybody knows what that is, as somebody that studies nutrition or physical activity. But the field of some happiness research falls under positive psychology. Mine was in health science, is a very relatively new field. And so I'm so excited to be a part of this exponential growth in researchers asking the question, what's right and how can I make it better? Because up until about the mid to late 80s, there wasn't a lot of peer-reviewed research on happiness. It was more what was wrong and how do we fix it, not what's going right, how can we learn from that, or how can we make it better? So that's where all of my interest in health promotion has always been there. It's just taken different vehicles for me to be able to learn about it.
I love that. You've collected so much information. Like, I mean, you are very passionate about research. Mm-hmm. This is your thing. I'm curious, based on what you've said, how do you even measure happiness? How is that measured amongst the people that you're looking to support?
Yeah, this is such a simple question with such a complicated answer. So this is kind of what happens in happiness research, is there's an answer and then there's nuance and there's caveats and there's different shades of gray. But what's interesting with happiness research, and just to even take a step back before we measure it, how do we define it, right? And
yeah,
you know, I bet if I was to ask you for a definition, or I was to give on myself, or you listening, if I asked you, how do you define happiness? The three of us would probably all have a similar but different definition. And yet we all have this mutual understanding of what happiness is. So it's kind of this interesting word and sort of surrounding it. And yet when you're a happiness researcher, this becomes highly problematic because at the beginning of every research study, you have to define your terms. So I have to explain what it is that I'm studying. And so often, and it's really hard. It's hard to encapsulate happiness into words because the English language can sometimes, I feel like, fall short of being able to fully describe what we experience or feel. It's like love, right? Like, how do you define love? It always falls short. It's a feeling so much in a different way. So in terms of happiness, the best definition that I have ever come across, one that is highly cited in the literature, comes from Dr. Sonia Lubomirsky, and she's one of the leading happiness researchers. She's from California. And the definition she uses, I use as well, is the experience of joy, contentment, or positive well-being combined with the sense that one's life is good, meaningful, and worthwhile. So essentially, basically, I like this definition because it sort of has two pieces. There's the in the moment, how you're feeling, you know, that joy or contentment, peace, whatever you want to call it. And then there's also this longevity or longer part, right? Where it's looking at it beyond just in the moment. Mm-hmm. And so all of that to say, once we've defined our terms, often in my research, I will use validated tools that researchers have created. So oftentimes it's a questionnaire, series of questions, and then you get a score. And then that score is sort of on a scale of 1 to 7 or 1 to 9. And then we get a sense from there where you fall in the range. What's interesting is there's so many different tools. So like in my dissertation, I actually used 4 different tools. So the Oxford Happiness Index, which was created by people at Oxford. There's also one that's really frequently used called the Subjective Happiness Scale. And that's actually was created by Dr. Lubomirsky that I was speaking about earlier with her definition. And it's only 4 items. So there's a range in terms of how many questions you can ask. But what I think is most fascinating is if I was to ask you right now on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy do you think you are right now in this moment?
I'm pretty happy right now. let's give it a little bit of wiggle room. I'd say I was a 9.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. And you know, asking ourselves that question with no judgment, right? We have some days where we're a 9 and some days where we're a 2. But checking in and whatever number we come up with. So for you right now, a 9, if I was to take one of my tools and give it to you and score it and figure it out, chances are the result that I got would be pretty close to what you said. So research has shown that as humans, we're actually pretty good at figuring out how happy we are. Our self-reported happiness is often very, very similar to what we would use in a research setting, for example, to figure out what makes us happy. The interesting thing, though, is what we're not as good at is figuring out what it is that makes us happy. So oftentimes we think it's, you know, the big shiny moments in our life. And I think we can attest this past year, right? With graduations and birthdays and holidays and all of that. We think those are the things that make us happiest. And yet research teaches us that it's actually the sum of small joys throughout our day that add up to a happier life. We often think it's the big moments because they may take up more mental real estate, right? We may think about them more. We anticipate them for longer. But yet, if we actually add up amount of time, when we can create opportunities throughout our day to have these small bursts, and I'm using small in terms of time, not in terms of impact, because it actually can be quite profound, because what happens is, and we kind of all can intuitively think about this, when something nice happens, you get an email from somebody that is a really, you know, wonderful email, or you're having a great conversation with a friend, or you're out for a walk on a beautiful day, you feel your mood shift. And from there, it creates what we call in research, like this upward spiral of positive emotion. So you can have the downward spiral too, right? Or the anxiety spiral. And we can relate to those too, because once you start, you just go down that spiral, but the spiral goes up as well. And so really thinking about where are these areas of opportunity that I have in my life throughout the day for these bursts, that's kind of the key piece when I think about how to structure or how to set up my day for happiness.
That's amazing. I'm blown away at how, when you when you asked me the number specifically mm-hmm. to rate myself, I think when you're given a tool like that and asked to mark yourself, mm-hmm. it takes away that search for the words. Like mm-hmm. we just said, the English language sort of falls flat when it comes to describing certain things.
Yeah.
But if you can mark yourself in some form of measurement, that allows for us to describe, because when I say nine, you know what nine means, yes. right? Like, you know, nine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without me having to tell you what nine feels like. Mm-hmm. I really like that. Now I have this question for you, because this has come up a lot of times in different things that I've read, different things that I've heard, listened to. I can't even pinpoint exactly where I heard it, but I heard joy and happiness being talked about as being different from one another. And what I learned, and maybe you can add to this, is that happiness is often something like this beautiful feeling. Again, I'll be at a loss for words to describe it. However, I've heard that happiness can be impacted significantly by external factors, whereas joy is this inside job. And maybe that is just a way for us to define it. But is that something that you can confirm or add anything to? I'm sure you can.
Yeah. You know, I actually get asked this question a lot. And I think it's really interesting because, and to be honest, this was something when I was preparing to defend my PhD. So you go and you have a 3-hour closed door oral exam where really smart professors ask you questions. And I was really, I had a lot of anxiety about them asking me about, you know, why did you choose happiness? Why not joy? What about the definition? What is happiness? And, you know, I really was reflecting on that. And I think where I sit with it, and depending on who you ask, you will get different answers. So sometimes you will talk to a happiness researcher who studies happiness as a more hedonic view of happiness. So for feeling, you know, in the moment, the daily pleasures, the joys of, you know, having a really delicious meal or, you know, going to the spa when we used to go there, yeah. Or whatever things that we have. And yet some other researchers look at it more from different perspectives where they look at things like subjective well-being. And in research, there's so many words for happiness in the research, whether it's, like I said, subjective well-being, positive well-being, positive emotions. And where I think I fall on this is call it whatever you want. We all want to feel good. And that going after that feeling, that's where my energy and attention goes. If someone wants to call it, and I mean, happiness too, it can be expressed in so many different ways. So I don't think of happiness in that sort of in the moment, feel good. I look at it from a broader perspective. And from there, what it does is it really opens up the umbrella to a variety of different adjectives or things to describe what it is. Because even think about expressions of happiness. So you look at someone that gets a touchdown at the Super Bowl and they're doing an end zone dance. They're pretty happy. Mm-hmm. You look at somebody meditating, you know, coming out of a yoga class and they're very blissful and tranquil and peaceful. If you ask them, they may be feeling happy as well. Sure. And so, and also within ourselves, it changes throughout our life. Like if we think about what we did that made us happy or how we expressed happiness when we were like 16 versus now versus when we're 100, right? So it's this constantly fluid, evolving feeling. And I think that the most empowering piece of this is that we get to choose how we label it, how we feel it, how we choose to create it. Whatever label we want to give it, cool, go for it. But prioritize that positivity, start to look for and create the experience for yourself. Because the other thing about happiness, and I've got to say, the most common thing that I get asked when I tell somebody I'm a happiness researcher, besides, is that a real job? The other one is, what's like the one thing? What's the one thing I need to like do or buy or get or say in order to be happy? And the truth is, like, there's no magic pill. There is, if there was, people would be selling it by now. And there's not a one thing. Happiness is universal in that we all like to and want to feel happy. And it drives a lot of our behaviors throughout our day, whether we realize it or not. And yet, each and every one of us have sort of this different formula for what makes us happy. And we can look to the research and data, as what I do all the time, to say, okay, well, what are the things that may increase my likelihood of feeling happiness? But that combination is different for each and every one of us. And it also changes throughout our lifespan. So part of, I guess, the good news and the bad news, depending on how you look at it, is we get to figure out what makes us happy. And then, so that's the good news. And for some people, the bad news is that we have to put in the work to do that. It's not a passive thing, right? Happiness doesn't just come to us and we sit here and we wait for it. A lot of it really is recognizing that a big piece of our happiness actually requires us to work at it and to really build that if we want to create and feel more happiness in our life.
That's the truth. I mean, anything worth having, right? Including happiness is going to require putting in the work. I wonder, when you're working, supporting people, what are some of the key suggestions that can be offered when you say prioritize your happiness? What do people, I know this would be a very general question, this will reach people in a variety of ways, but what specifically can people do to prioritize their happiness? Is it small shifts? Is it an overhaul? What is it that would allow us to elevate that sense, that feeling that we're all desiring?
I love this question. And I will get to a couple. But before that, I think the number one thing, the best place to start, in my opinion, is first of all, rethinking how we view happiness, changing the lens that we look through in terms of happiness. And what I mean by that is, you know, so often we think, I will be happy when, fill in the blank, right? When I have X amount of dollars, car, size, whatever, kids move out, get married, get divorced, whatever. We all have these sort of stories. And we think that happiness is a destination. Like, one day I'll get there and then I'll be happy. So step number one is really recognizing that that's not a thing, right? We don't ever arrive at happiness and then we're good and we're happy for the rest of our life. That's not how it works. So the way I think about happiness is the same way I think about nutrition, or the same way I think about movement and exercise and physical fitness. So what I mean by that is, you know, I would never make a green smoothie today and give it to you and put like all the superfoods in it and give it to you and you drink it and you say, oh, thanks, Jillian, I've reached nutritional wellness. Good, right? I don't have to eat. No, you want to have dinner later tonight, right? And breakfast tomorrow. And so we know that if we want to be healthy, we have to choose healthy food most of the time, right? And we have to continually eat for our entire life, or fitness. Like, we would never go into the gym back when we used to go to gyms, or go and do our home workout. We would never finish that workout. You would never do that. And then text me and be like, hey, Jill, just had the best workout of my life. I've reached fitness. Right? Wouldn't happen. We understand that we need to move our bodies regularly, and it takes work and it takes effort. But if we want to be fit and healthy and strong, that's what we need to do. So first of all, just completely shifting and looking at happiness through the same lens that we view nutrition, or the same lens that we view physical activity, where it's a practice. It's something that we have to do on a regular basis. I think that for me has been one of the most like fundamental cognitive shifts. And what I love about that is, because then we recognize that our happiness can be created now, we're not going to get to it one day, then we realize that we have this opportunity to figure out, how do I do that? Because it's possible today. We don't have to wait for some mythical time in the future to get to happiness.
That's and beautiful to think of.
Right? And the other piece I think that's really important to know too is, in terms of happiness research, like I was telling you earlier, like, it's a fairly new field. And some of the first emerging data had this theory of basically, they called it like a set point theory. So the idea was that we all have a set point for happiness, whatever it is, kind of like a thermostat in your house, right? You have a set how warm or cold you want your house to be. And then you may leave the door open, so then it gets a little bit warmer, and then you shut the door and then it gets a little cooler, or whatever happens, but your room always goes back to that same temperature, right? And so there's fluctuations here and there, but it goes back to what it always was. So this was the thought about happiness. You know, we have something good happen to us and our happiness goes up. And then we go back to baseline, and then something challenging or difficult or sad happens, and we see a drop in our happiness. And then we kind of go back to baseline. And what we know now is that we do not have a set point for happiness. Each and every one of us, no matter how happy or unhappy we're feeling right now, we all have the capacity and the ability to not only increase happiness in our life, but to sustain it at an elevated level. And I think that that is so cool and so empowering. And so then, okay, well, how do I do that? Well, we do know from the research that there is a genetic element to happiness. So we can thank our parents or not. Yeah. Some of us are born more like Eeyore type, and some of us are not. Some of us are sort of more sun is shining type. So that's a contributor to our happiness, our genetics. The other major contributor is in our environment. I think we can all appreciate that given the past year and how our environment has really affected our mood. And then there's this third piece. And this other third piece is the key piece, in my opinion, and where all of my research focuses. And that's the piece that's up to us. So that's our thoughts, our actions, and our behaviors. And so when you think about, okay, which of these three key pieces is the lowest hanging fruit or the most amenable to change? Can't change our genes, maybe gene expression a little bit, but very, very difficult. Environment. I mean, we can change our environment. I had a friend that moved out west when the pandemic hit. So, you know, him and his family, they changed their environment, but again, very difficult to do. But if we think about our thoughts, our actions, and our behaviors, that's all up to us. That is completely internally controlled. And so when we can focus on that piece, knowing that it plays a key role in terms of our overall happiness, and at the same time, it's something that we can actually do and we don't have to look externally, and it's within our control. And so that's what I find really empowering. And I have seen this in my own personal data, as well as so many other research studies, that yeah, it's actually possible to increase it and we can maintain it at a higher thing. And that's not to say though, that somebody's happy all the time, because I think that's the other sort of piece of happiness is that we think, and in all honesty, when I first started studying happiness, part of my personal motivation was I didn't want to feel some of the more challenging emotions. I didn't want to feel sad. I don't want to feel anxiety. I don't want to feel down or depressed or low, fear. So I wanted to, from a personal perspective, be like, okay, well, Jillian, you're a researcher. So why don't you just figure out how to be happy all the time? It sounds like a good idea, right? Yeah. And I did at the time. And what I quickly learned was that no. The goal is not happiness all the time. And in fact, there is research that shows that people that essentially like put their blinders on and they prioritize happiness as their goal, all they want to do is be happy all the time. That's sort of the whole driving motivation of all of their things. I want to be happy all the time. Those people are actually less happy. So recognizing that happiness is a part of the collective human experience, the range of emotions or feelings that we have. And yet it's not the only one, and achieving or finding or whatever word you want to use, feeling happiness all the time is not even optimal. And in fact, it's not even possible. So what happens is if we set our goal to be happy all the time, we're never going to achieve that because it's not possible. And so we are continually disappointed. We can feel down on ourselves, hard on ourselves. So knowing that we can take the pressure off ourselves because we don't have to feel happy all the time. In fact, it's actually healthy in terms of psychological functioning to not be happy all the time. That's not to say that we can't create more happiness in our life, but I think part of it too is really appreciating the fact that no, happiness is a piece of life. It's a wonderful piece of life, and it's not always that, and that is okay.
That makes beautiful sense to me. In fact, for those of you listening, you'd be interested to know that Dr. Jillian Mandich has spoke on two separate TED Talks. You're going to want to check those out for sure. And I'll put them in the show notes so you can do that. But you spoke in one of your talks about the dark side of happiness. Mm-hmm. I loved when you explored that because I thought, what an interesting statement, the dark side of happiness. Nobody really pairs those two words together, nor do we give any thought really to what that could possibly be. And I want to say that what you've just described, this need for experiencing all emotions, is tied to this idea of the dark side of happiness, or how you can try so hard to be happy. And when you don't reach that level, you're disappointing yourself and feeling the angst or whatever emotions arise from that disappointment. And that creates the dark side of your pursuit. Yeah. It's a really interesting phenomenon.
Yeah. You know, it really is. And sort of another layer to it is that, like, you know, if you reflect back on your life, or I reflect back on my life, or you listening right now, reflect some of the really dark, challenging, difficult, stressful times in our life have challenged our resilience. And yet the sort of byproduct of that is that we got through and it helped us show us what we're capable of, because we proved it to ourselves because we got through. We've experienced pain and loss. And when we have that, those feelings, or we've experienced those things, we appreciate the good even more. So part of it too, you know, what is highly correlated with happiness is resilience. And I think, you know, especially this past year, a lot, everything has completely changed. And yet, like, if you think about remembering back to last March, when everybody was told, okay, the world is shutting down and you're going to work from home and kids are going to, all of this, what happened? We all freaked out. We started panicking, but then what happened? We figured it out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when we have these uncertain, uncharted, unfamiliar, difficult times, those really show us what we're capable of and how resilient and persistent and that humans can really be.
That's really true. And I believe that I've seen such beautiful examples of that. I've seen people ebb and flow, and their resilience has just been something that will follow them for their entire lives. And myself included, I think about, you mentioned last March, 2020, and there really was this sense of fear, this doom and gloom based on, how am I going to do this? I don't know how to do this. I can't do this. And it was this layer upon layer of negative emotion. And yet as you move through it and find small happiness, happiness is in every single day. Like we've heard people talk about having a meal around the dinner table for the first time with their family. Like that's just not something that they ever did. And yet now the opportunity presents itself for that to happen. That's a happy moment. And it creates these amazing talking opportunities amongst the entire family. You get more connected to one another. And there's another element to it all. I think before, our days were all so hectic that we weren't really investigating what anyone else in the family did. It was, you come in the house, you do your thing, you head out and do whatever it is that you do, and then everybody comes home and heads to bed. And you don't really know the details of the day. However, this has given us this opportunity to find out more about one another, find out what makes each other tick. And that is that's a happy experience in and of itself. And that has certainly created resilience in the construct of family.
Yeah. Yeah.
Happiness and resilience.
I love it. What you're describing right now, you know, in the research world, sometimes called benefit finding. And I love this practice because essentially in every situation, no matter how difficult, there are still benefits or good things, right? Even in really challenging things, like for example, you know, go back to March last year, right? A lot of chaos, but like you said, there still are benefits. Maybe we've never had a family dinner before. Maybe your partner was traveling all the time and you didn't get to enjoy evenings together. Maybe your kids, you never really knew what they were doing at school or what they were learning. And now you, so not to say that bad things don't happen or that we put our blinders on and we don't see those things. Cause I think that's another piece, is being happy or cultivating happiness is not about looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. It's not about pretending everything's okay when it's not. The way I see it is when we look at the world from a realistically optimistic perspective, that's kind of the secret sauce, because we have a angle, a lean towards optimism. And research shows that people that are more optimistic live longer, have lower rates of cardiovascular disease. They have stronger and more fulfilling marriages and relationships. So And optimism, about 25% of that is genetic. So the vast majority of our optimism is actually a learned behavior. It's a skill that you can learn, just like problem solving, just like so many other skills. We can actually cultivate a lot of optimism. So when we lean towards optimism, and at the same time, we're realistic. So we're not just pretending like everything's okay when it's not, because what in terms of healthy psychological functioning, whatever we're feeling, the key is to feel it fully. If we're having a bad day, and we're sad and we want to watch The Notebook and have a good cry, then hey, why not? Feel it, cry. It can actually feel very good sometimes to have those releases and process the emotions. So what happens is, the question is not, do I want to have some of these more challenging emotions? It's, I want to welcome whatever I'm feeling without being too judgmental with myself, welcoming it with compassion and feeling it, and not marinating in it for weeks or months or something like that. That's the key, is kind of that marination phase where we don't want to play in that space. Right. And when we do that, I think what's really cool about happiness is that as we start to focus on our thoughts, our actions, and our behaviors and do things that make us happier, whatever those are for us, it's like almost like a muscle. Like, you know, I was talking about going to the gym earlier. If you think about happiness like a muscle, so the more you use it, the stronger you get, right? And so the more you start to look for opportunities to create those small bursts throughout your day, the happier you become, your happiness muscle grows. And so then what you see is that your highs in life, they get higher, and your lows, they also get higher. So we're not getting rid of the lows, but we're seeing this uptrend where everything is getting higher. Everything is elevated. Our highs get even higher, and then the lows as well. So it's not about getting rid of them. It's about moving them in this uptrend as we really cultivate and grow our happiness muscle.
This is such a powerful thing for us to know, because I'm immediately feeling this sense of hopefulness. And I'm sure I'm not the only one listening to this, where it's like, I am limitless in terms of my capacity for happiness. Mm-hmm. And practicing it, the very act of practicing happiness is something that the thought of it brings you joy. Do you know what I mean? Like it's really, of course you do.
I'm totally on board with that.
I'm kind of curious. You've mentioned genetics. You mentioned the optimism piece. 25% of our optimism would be genetic.
Yeah, about 25%.
About there.
Play with the number. But yeah, a lot of it we can actually.
We're mostly in control of it. I'm kind of curious about our brains in general. Like, is there an anatomical place in the brain where happiness resides? Mm. Like, are we able to affect it in a literal sense?
So yes, and we can see there's, depending on what's causing it, we can see different areas of the brain light up. What's interesting is that when we look at like fMRIs studying, neurological studying, when you get a financial reward or a reward like that, the same area of your brain lights up than when you're feeling happy sometimes. And so we have sort of certain pleasure centers in the brain. And then on top of that, the other piece is that there are certain hormones that can make us feel good. You know, for example, like dopamine, right? We get these hits when someone likes our post, or we, you know, someone gives us a compliment, or we have something yummy to eat, oxytocin, right? Like that's our cuddling hormone. So these hormones, neurotransmitters, chemicals impact our happiness. And I think that's an important piece for us to discuss, because one of the questions I get asked a lot is about antidepressants or SSRIs and how they fit into all of this. Mm-hmm. And the way I think about it is like this. If I ask you to build a house and you're like, okay, Jillian, I'll build a house. So you go out and get all the things you need to build a house. You get windows and doors and cement and bricks and all the things. And then you put the house, you build the house, right? If nobody brings you doors or windows, your house isn't fully built. And sometimes our body, for whatever reason, physiologically, biochemically, for whatever reason, may not be producing, say, for example, the precursors to serotonin or dopamine or the receptors that communicate with them. So I really believe that there is a time and a place to have a conversation with your doctor if things are feeling off or you're concerned, and to have that, because if you don't have all the building blocks to build a house, You can't build a house. No amount of affirmations and gratitude is going to bring a front door to your house if you do not have a front door. So that being said, a lot of the practices, especially in my research, when I think about thoughts, actions, and behaviors, can still have a positive effect. So they're not one or the other. And if you are listening right now and you or someone that you know is wondering, you know, do I have all the pieces to build a house, or does someone I know, there absolutely is a time and a place to have those conversations with our doctors. I think that there's a lot of stigma around that. But if you don't, if your body's not working the way that it does, or it doesn't have enough of whatever hormone it is, then that's a piece of it too. So I think that's something, you know, important. And I've seen so many changes in people sometimes when they get all the building blocks to their house finally, and then it starts to get put together. So, you know, in conjunction with other things, and having that conversation with your doctor sometimes can be beneficial.
I can't say thank you enough for even coming to this topic, because I think mental wellness has become a major focus for me, especially in the past year. You see varying degrees of examples of how it has shifted for people. And I think it's a powerful thing to know that there is a time and a place to have that conversation. What would you suggest for someone who maybe isn't quite at that space yet, but is feeling more than usual moments of anxiety and more than usual moments of what they may just describe as depression?
Mm-hmm. I can speak from personal experience too. You know, I think this past year we've all had a lot more, and many of us, myself included, I've felt more anxiety in this past year than I have probably in my entire life. And so then I think about it, and I'm like, okay, Jillian, what are you going to do about this? You know the research and you know the data. So what are you doing? And so for me personally, one of the things I've noticed about anxiety is, or even feeling depressed or depression symptoms or depressive symptoms or low, our brain is often in the past or in the future, right? We're thinking about what we're missing out on, or what may happen if, or things like that. And we can get into these spirals, right? These anxiety spirals can be very, very challenging to get out of, where we have one thought and then that thought leads to another thought and another thought and another thought, and then all of a sudden the world's ending. And so for me, a couple of practices that are really potent happiness boosters, and at the same time, keep us in the present moment, which I think can be a key piece of this. One of them is savoring. So savoring is essentially like the research term of stopping to smell the roses, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's about being so present in the moment with what you're doing and finding joy and pleasure in that. So whether that be, you know, taking a couple minutes in the morning to have your coffee, and not just like down your coffee as you're chasing the kids, but smell your coffee. Sip your coffee, feel the warmth of the mug, like all of that. When you start to savor, one of the powerful byproducts of that is that you're in the moment, you're fully present. So your brain is not going to what may or may not happen later today, or what may or may not have happened last night. So that is a powerful practice to snap us back into the moment. And something that, because we can, you know, grab our glass of water and really focus on that, it sometimes can be something tangible. So that can be helpful. The other thing I think with anxiety in particular, sometimes when I start to catch myself in an anxiety spiral, I'll do this short little activity to sort of get me back into my body and into the moment. Cause I notice that I'm way off in the future of like, oh my goodness, you know, nothing's going to open up again and this and that, or whatever the story is. So what I'll do is I'll look around the room that I'm in and just look for three things. Just notice three things. You know, I have my monitor, and I have my mouse, and I have my phone. Okay. So then start to listen for one or two sounds that are going on. And so, you know, might be like the buzzing of my monitor, or, you know, whatever it is, maybe you hear the birds chirping outside, and then trying to see what you smell. So just smelling, you know, maybe someone's cooking dinner at your house and you can smell it waffling down the hall or whatever it is. But what we do is, by looking around, we're engaging our visual senses. By listening, we're engaging our hearing. And then smelling through our nose, right? Thinking about what we smell. And what that does is, it's an actual concrete thing that we can do, right? It's not so ethereal, or it's concrete. It's like, okay, look around. What do you see? What do you smell? What do you hear? But it brings you into the present moment. And that, you know, if you've never done it before, I really want to invite you to try this practice, because it can stop that spiral before it gets worse. And I think that that's something that for me has been a major shift, because it's not about not feeling them, but it's not letting yourself go down that rabbit hole.
Not letting it dominate.
Yeah. Yes.
It's so simple. I appreciate you sharing both of those techniques with us, because I feel like those are two, like you said, they're so simple, so easy to do. Literally anyone at any time, anywhere can participate in either of those two practices. I think that is amazing. And if you have done it before, amazing, great. But if you haven't, maybe today is the day that you try. You know, if you've already had your morning coffee, that's one thing, but there's certainly something else within your day where you can spend some time savoring, observing, spending time in that moment. Cultivate your happiness. As Dr. Jillian has already expressed, it's so important to prioritize your happiness. And these techniques are a simple, easy, and may I say affordable way for us to access happiness. It's really quite incredible. I'm going to wrap things up here because I want to be very respectful of your time. And I'm so curious, because you've done so much research and you have spent and dedicated so much time into supporting people with their overall health and wellness, particularly in the arena of happiness. Who are your guideposts? Who are your mentors?
Ooh, I don't know if I've ever been asked this question. So this
is a fun one. Because it's like you need to be filled too. So I'm so curious about who that is.
Yeah. So I think top of my list is my mom. Mm-hmm. My mom has been such a profound role model and influence in my life. So I'm the oldest of 7 kids in my family. And after my mom had my youngest sister, she went back to school and got a PhD. And so my mom had 7 kids under 9 while doing her PhD. So when I was going through school, first of all, I got zero sympathy, right? And what my mom did was my mom taught me that anything is possible. And she taught me by showing me. And that has been such a gift for me, because she had a dream of getting a PhD and she had 7 kids under 9 or 7 kids under 9 years old and did it. And so that has been such a blessing in my life, that I've always believed that anything is possible. Just figure out how. It's the how piece. It's not an if it's possible, yes or no. And even from a research perspective, my mom, really, really amazing. In terms of what podcasts I've been listening to and reading and stuff lately, a couple of my favorites, Brené Brown, you know, we all know and love her. She's amazing. I think because she's a researcher and such an amazing storyteller, I really connect with a lot of her work. A book that I actually, this is the first book in my life that I listened to the Audible and then bought the hard copy.
Oh, I'm so curious. First one ever
is a book called Think Again by Adam Grant. And I think if you've been listening to this podcast and any of the research stuff has resonated, what I love about this book is the entire book is about thinking like a scientist. Not that you have to be a scientist, but learning how the scientific process works and how we think and what that means. And I think this is especially with a lot of conversations going on in the world right now, but a lot of hot button issues. Instead of taking in, Adam Grant kind of breaks down 3 types of, he talks about preachers. So a lot of times preacher type people will get up and they'll share their information, like a preacher on Sunday sharing his sermon. These are my thoughts. A prosecutor is another perspective where it's like a lawyer building a case. So here's my thought, and here's all the reasons why I'm right and you're wrong. And then a politician. So this is kind of that like charismatic, maybe high energy, maybe magnetic type of person who's sharing their information. And so the 4th category that Adam talks about is this idea of thinking like a scientist, which is being a critical thinker, which is using data and learning about things and asking questions and not being attached to an answer, being open to whatever evolves. So our identity is not wrapped up in an answer. And I think that and it's a very accessible book. Adam is a great writer. He's got amazing stories in it. The opening of the book talks about like the Smoke Jumpers, you know, the movie, and sort of what in there. So it's a very accessible, relevant book that has been really influential in terms of sort of shaping even how I thought about my thinking like a scientist, put words into how I've been thinking for a long time. But it gives a really great opportunity to start to learn and to question things and to be aware of what we're consuming and how we're consuming it.
Mm. It sounds amazing. Think Again by Adam Grant. Mm-hmm. He would be one of your guideposts and your mom. I hope your mom gets to hear this because
I'm going to send it to her.
Your mom, every mom deserves to hear this, right? All the credit. How can we stay connected with you and follow along with wherever your journey takes you next?
Yeah. So my website is a good hub. Everything is kind of goes from there. And that's jillianmandich.com. And I'm Jillian with a G if you're listening right now. So it's GILLIANMANDICH.com. My social media handle on all, I'm on like every social, but TikTok, I think. And it's just
at Jillian Mandich. Kind of did the dances.
Yeah, I know. I've thought about it, but I haven't gone there yet. I have too many inboxes as it is.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's lots of places that we can meet up with you again and follow it is what you're doing. I just want to say a gigantic thank you for agreeing to sit with me for a little while, share your wisdom, share your heart. Like I said before, in the beginning, you've always been someone that I have looked to for guidance and someone who, you know, just has the ability to make people feel like part of your process. And I think that that is a really rare quality to find in people anymore. So I really appreciate you. And on behalf of everyone, I just want to say thanks a million. Dr. Jillian Mandich, you are amazing.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I really, our conversation today was so special and it was such an enjoyable time together. And I think that the work you're doing is so wonderful. And I celebrate you for that and keep shining your light because it's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, everyone, thank you so much for joining the show today, always with so much gratitude. I hope you will like and share this with friends. Send me your feedback. I'd love to know what you think about it. And until we meet again, take good care of yourself, health and happiness, everyone. Well, that's a wrap for today's episode, friends. Thank you for hanging out with us here at the Planting Wildflowers podcast. We'll look forward to seeing you again real soon. And in the meantime, if you would be so kind as to rate, subscribe, and share this podcast with others, I'd be most grateful. We'll catch you again soon. Until then, take good care.